Fourth World Man by John Quentin. And let it be noted that there is no more delicate matter to take in hand, nor more perilous to conduct, nor more uncertain in its success, than to set oneself up as a leader in the introduction of changes. For he who innovates will have for his enemies all those who profit under the existing order of things, and only lukewarm defenders in those who might profit under the new. This lukewarm temper arises partly from the fear of adversaries who have the laws on their side, and partly from the incredulity of mankind, who will never admit the merit of anything new until they have long seen it proved by the event. Niccolò Machiavelli, The Prince, 1532. Chapter 1. Exceptional Evidence. Henry Bell watched as his friend Alex Wilson, known to everyone as Tug, was the first to go up to the collecting station and confirm his identity. Once the white-coated medical officer was satisfied, he said, "Here you are. Wipe this swab firmly around the inside of your mouth. That's the best way to get plenty of your cheek cells to stick to it, and they're what we want from you. Then just pop it into the pot, please. And that's it. Thank you, Wilson. Next up, please." Henry had a good idea what the analysis of Tug's DNA might reveal about his recent ancestry. His parentage was easy enough to guess, but he had no idea if any unknown or unsuspected things would be revealed. As he sat waiting, Henry pondered seriously for the first time what secrets his own genome might reveal about him. He imagined everybody waiting to give their cell sample was having similar thoughts. Unlike most of them, Henry had no idea about his family background beyond his parents. They had always been distant. It seemed that for as long as he could remember, he had found as little time for them as they had for him. And he knew nothing about their backgrounds. Now, after their bizarre deaths and the events that had followed, he was trying hard to forget about them and his former life that involved them and their strange, secretive acquaintances. He knew that he was rated as highly intelligent, fit and healthy, mentally and physically robust and extraordinarily strong, even among his fellow commandos. He had always been told that he had exceptional prospects, but he was modest to a fault. He never tried deliberately to stand out. He had always thought of himself as normal, whatever that meant. If this genetic analysis revealed nothing abnormal in his DNA, he'd not be told anything anyway. If he was that interested in what he had to say about him, he could always pay to have a test done. Plenty of companies offered them. Right now, he was not much bothered. It bothered him far more that the MO kept glancing over at him. A week earlier, the commanding officer had briefed the regiment on the Ministry of Defence's project to capture every service person's DNA. It was something to do with making identification of remains easier. There would be no more anonymous war graves, apparently. Henry's regiment was part of a small pilot project to demonstrate the concept. Off script, as usual, the colonel had said, "I want volunteers to surrender a tiny fraction of your body, potentially a great deal of your privacy, and possibly your dignity, those of you who have any, for the greater good." Everybody had laughed with him, and everybody had volunteered with him. Later, in the technical briefing, Henry had heard, but not really listened, to all the stuff about privacy, data protection, and medical ethics. He had only paid any real attention when the briefing covered the one thing that did trouble him: the possibility of genetic abnormalities and defects being identified. Henry knew it was unscientific that just 100 individuals were to be involved at this stage, all from his unit, 24 Commando Regiment, Royal Engineers. Everybody in the regiment was a decently educated and intelligent, sparky, healthy, fit, strong, resilient young man. And that meant it was hardly a broad or representative group from which to take samples. Doubtless there would be some logic or agenda behind it. Whatever the rationale was, he assumed it was no concern of his. Looking around, it was obviously not bothering anyone else either. He dismissed the thought, then smiled to himself at an altogether different thought. He tried to imagine the grossly politically incorrect discussions the RSM and all the squadron sergeant majors would have had when picking the 100 donors whose samples would contribute to the program. It would amuse them to know if certain people had traits and characteristics in their genes. Henry looked at his watch again, shook his head and sighed. As there was nothing else to read, he started leafing through a pile of tatty old copies of National Geographic. Every edition seemed to have one item about high technology or the future, and another about evolution or prehistoric civilizations. He skipped over the usual collection of folksy pieces on small-town rural America, surviving pockets of quaint old Europe and bold big city emerging Asia. Instead, he whiled away the wait, looking over the more objective and scientific items. He scanned a few and eventually lost himself in an article about the experimental restoration of the mammoth steppe ecosystem in Siberia. "And the last, but by no means least, please," the MO said, hailing Henry. "Morning, young man. Please give me your surname, first name, and date of birth." "Kong. No known first name. Date of birth unknown. Sir." "King Kong, I presume. I must say, your simian majesty, you're smaller and, well, frankly, less hairy than I had imagined. Is that hairy or furry?" "Aye, whatever. It'll be rather interesting after 10 million years evolutionary separation to see how similar your genome is to a gorilla's. We still share 96% of our genes with them, but maybe you've kept a few more than the rest of us. Let's start the process of finding out, shall we?"
"Sorry, sir. I just couldn't help myself," Henry said. "It's been a long morning."
"For you and me both. And I need you to tell me that you were born on April the 1st, and your real name is Juan Kerr or Harry Pucking Futter, like I need a second hole in my backside just now. You're not a wand-toting boy wizard rather than a blonde-toting giant ape, are you?" the MO asked, while removing a packet of sterile surgical gloves and putting them on. Shaking his head, Henry started to recite. "Bell, Henry, 29th of February.
Ah!
The elusive 29th of February. Now that's your diagnostic identifier," the MO interrupted. It was as if Henry was the first person that he had ever met who had been born on the date that gives you a birthday on your actual birth date only once every 4 years. "Confused about your real age, I shouldn't wonder. Now then, I just need to wipe this swab firmly around the inside of your cheek, if I may. It'll minimise the potential for cross-contamination if I do it myself with these sterile gloves on. We'll need a good splodge of cells so we can get a decent sample of your DNA. Once I've dropped it into this pot, sealed and bagged it, we're all done. Then you can go and, run through Manhattan with a girl under your arm and climb up the Empire State Building or something." Henry grinned, but also noted with rising suspicion that the MO had been unusually chatty with him and that his was the only sample taken with such care. He gave nothing away in case it was something he was not supposed to have noticed. "It'll have to wait, sir. We're off up to Scotland on exercise the day after tomorrow. I'm really looking forward to it. Sounds like it's going to be pretty wild." The MO, a Scot, Henry had already noticed, shrugged and offered wistfully, "I'd take old Ricky over the Big Apple every time." Then he asked Henry to confirm his full name, rank, army number, date of birth and blood group. That would satisfy him that the labelling on the sample collection packaging was correct and was correctly matched to Henry.
"Is that it, sir?" Henry asked, as the MO's silent but very watchful assistant sealed the labelled clear plastic transit bag containing his swab in its pot.
Yes, that's it, thank you. You're free to go now. Well, sort of, anyway. And we must go away, too. We'll have the results back sometime soon, and enjoy the follow-up. Look after yourself in the meantime. Bye then, Henry."
"Thank you, sir," Henry replied and left.
And with what he knew had been a very strange, unexpectedly familiar and somehow informative dismissal, that supposedly was that. But the MO had given him enough hints to know that it was anything but.
"Young Bell, where are you?"
asked Staff Sergeant Taff Morris. He looked up from his clipboard at the troop mustered for first parade and spotted Henry.
"Soon as I fall a troop out, Bell, get yourself over the med centre. That's all a message I got. I'm speculating it's to discuss the result of that scan you had the other week, remember, when everybody else was given their DNA sample. Well, apparently, they located one or two rogue brain cells floating around in an anomalously thick, misshapen skull. Let me know when you get back."
There was a guffaw from the rest of the troop, not only at the fun being poked at Sapper Henry Bell, but also because to them, giving a DNA sample was synonymous with the equally euphemistic and intimate exchanging body fluids.
"I'll let you know what they say, Staff. Unless what passes for my brain's too primitive to understand what I'm being told," Henry retorted.
That prompted another collective guffaw and an indulgent smile from Staff Sergeant Morris. He enjoyed the lad's banter. He was generally edgy and funny. Some of them were real comedians.
but it always just managed to stay respectful. And when no backchat was appropriate, there was no backchat. When the troop had been dismissed to their morning's duties, Henry made his way over to the base medical centre. He presented himself at the reception desk. "Morning, ladies. Sapper Bell from 2-4. I was told to come over. I don't know what for, sorry. Any ideas?" "That'll be to see me," said an authoritative-sounding man's voice behind him. "Follow me, please. We'll do the introductions when we're out of the way." And with that, the big 30-something man strode off. Henry followed, still none the wiser as to why they were meeting. He immediately noted a couple of things about this man. The first was that his smart civilian clothes did little to hide his military physique and demeanour. The second was that he was a northerner, probably from Manchester, although he had evidently lived away for a long time. Henry was a talented impressionist and had a good ear for accents and where people were from. He just could not help himself. It was more a reflex than a habit. Once they were in one of the consulting rooms, the man stopped, turned and smiled. Henry closed the door and stood facing his unannounced and still anonymous visitor. "Sorry about that. Needs must, I'm afraid. I'm Dr. Theo Conway from the Defence Science and Technology Laboratories, usually just known as DSTL. Basically, we're the government's in-house defence research managers. For my sins, I manage the Future Workforce and Human Performance Programme. I doubt it means anything to you now, although I'm sure it will, but that's what I do. It's Henry, isn't it?" he said, offering his hand. "Yes, sir. Sapper Bell. Henry Bell. Henry. Pleased to meet you." Henry took the proffered hand and shook it firmly. He half expected to feel some sort of Masonic thumb press or finger curl next, but there was nothing. "I'm guessing the genome pilot thing we did comes under your programme," he said. Yeah, it does," said Dr. Conway, sounding surprised. "Please call me Theo. I'm not military, so I don't have to do ranks and titles. Nor do you right now. Have a seat," he said, gesturing and taking the lead by sitting down himself. Henry noted that although it was on the warm side in the close confines of the room, Dr. Conway kept his jacket on and closed with a single button. He noticed it, like he had noticed the different way his cell sample had been collected, and it set him thinking. Noticing anomalies and inconsistencies like these, and trying to rationalise them, was another of his instincts. Again, he gave the impression that he had not noticed anything unusual or abnormal. First of all, Henry, thanks for volunteering to take part in the pilot programme. I assume you're fully aware of what it's all about." Fully enough, thanks," Henry replied. "Good. We in the DNA project have..." Dr. Conway paused briefly, as if unsure of the right phrase to use. "Let's call them shared technical interests with all sorts of organisations around the world. We have links to universities and institutes that are pushing back the frontiers of DNA sequencing techniques, genome analysis and interpretation all the time. Genetics and bioengineering are where the science that really matters is all happening. IT and AI might be making all the big noisy headlines today, but selectively enhanced, bioengineered life is tomorrow's real news. It'll advance our control of medical science, maybe even life itself in ways we can only dream of. The possibilities are limited only by our imagination and what the law permits. At least that's a theory anyway," he said. He gave Henry what he thought was a disarming smile. Henry, not disarmed by it, nodded back. He also furrowed his brow a little. Even if he knew roughly where Dr. Conway was coming from, he wasn't quite sure where he was going with this, but he thought he had just heard a clue. Did you know that as well as being unique to each of us, our genome's also a record of our ancestry? Not just recent ancestry, or even 10, 20 generations back. We've got genes whose origins predate our emergence as a distinct species. You ever heard of paleoanthropology? As I understand, it's the branch of anthropology concerned with the origins and development of early humans. Isn't it also called human paleontology? Ah, impressive. Straight out of the dictionary, said Dr. Conway, looking surprised, because uncannily it was. He continued. Places like the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, there's another term for you, have been working for years on sequencing ancient hominin DNA and mapping it across to the modern human genome. That's created the new discipline of paleogenetics, so there's yet another. They've already pretty much rewritten the story of modern human evolution and migration. They're busy replacing speculation with facts and opinions based on hard data. Hard data derived from hard fossils, more to the point. So what? No God then, Henry said. He enjoyed taking opportunities to be mischievous, even if it was sometimes inappropriate, and at other times provocative. No God, confirmed Dr. Conway. Then he added, no fossil remains, no directly attributable DNA sample. Ergo, no God, but at least not yet anyway. Huh. Does my genome say that I'm a fully evolved specimen of Homo sapiens sapiens? That's a doubly wise question, Dr. Conway said, smiling. Well, let me answer it by not answering it, at least not yet. I need to tell you a story first. Henry thought that not giving a simple, straight answer to a simple, straight question meant the eventual answer, if he was going to get one at all, would be neither simple nor straight. Intuitively, he understood this story was not for his entertainment. Something dark about Dr. Conway suggested he was not really the storytelling type anyway. Did you know that most of us, you and I certainly, have a little bit of Neanderthal DNA in our genome? That we have both modern humans and Neanderthals as ancestors. Does that surprise you? I wasn't aware, Henry answered. His response was not entirely truthful. There had been an article on it in one of the National Geographic magazines in the medical centre. Dr. Conway had also alluded to it, albeit vaguely, when he had mentioned cross-referencing ancient hominin and modern human genomes. Henry was certain he had just heard another clue about the purpose of the visit. He also began to get the feeling that he was being subjected to some rather clumsy neurolinguistic programming. Well, for Europeans, Western Asians and their descendants on other continents, his typical range lies between 1.8 to about 2.4%, which is higher than estimated when this was first discovered. Some have more, of course. Sub-Saharan Africans, by contrast, generally have none, especially among archaic and isolated populations like the Khoisan. It gets quite complicated when we consider gene exchanges in both directions between Neanderthals and humans that occurred involving very ancient human populations that might not have survived. But where it gets really complex is in Eastern Asia and beyond in Oceania. As well as Neanderthal DNA, their genomes also include Denisovan DNA. The Neanderthals lived in the Levant, Western Asia and Europe, including briefly in southern Britain. The Denisovans were a sibling population that existed in Central and Eastern Asia, which is where we see their genetic legacy. It's thought, if you're interested, that Tibetans and Sherpas prosper at altitude thanks to their inherited Denisovan genes. Eastern Asians typically retain about 2.3 to 2.6% Neanderthal DNA. Again, some have more. But, now get this, there are certain ethnic groups, Melanesians for example, who've got up to 5 or even 6% Denisovan DNA. Oh, and in Denisovan DNA, there's evidence of another as yet unidentified human ancestor. And as if that wasn't complex enough, recent research suggests a significant contribution from another unidentified human ancestor into the genome of sub-Saharan Africans. That theory suggests that by not considering these findings, estimates of our Neanderthal DNA quotient may be off by some way, maybe a factor of 3 or so. We'll have to see where that one goes. Talking about all these ancestors, it's thought that about 100,000 years ago, there were probably 6 different species of humans, possibly all around at the same time, if not necessarily in the same place. Dr. Conway paused, deliberately for effect. But, all other things considered, I'd say the most interesting thing is that we're still here, and all the others are long extinct. Chapter 2. A Fantastic Human Story. Dr. Conway opened a secure-looking briefcase. Without letting Henry see what was in it, he drew out a slim laptop and some printed material. Okay, I'm assuming you're sitting comfortably, so I'll begin. The Neanderthals, the Denisovans and us, Homo sapiens that is, evolved from a common ancestor that we shared around 700,000 years ago, Homo heidelbergensis. As you can see, we don't look like any of the others, and looking at them, I'd say that evolution did us a big favour there. About 600,000 years ago, some Heidelbergensis migrated from their home in northeast Africa into Asia. From there, they spread right across Asia and Europe. They also migrated within Africa, spreading westwards and southwards. This is all big hand, small map stuff, and give or take a few tens, those thousands of years, you understand. This very simple diagram shows it nicely. The migration wasn't a deliberate exodus or plantation. It was nothing like the Pilgrim Fathers setting off to settle a new world, transportation to Australia, or shipping huge numbers of people from West Africa to the Caribbean and the Americas. More like casual drifting, probably along habitable and hospitable land corridors and coastlines, as conditions allowed. Think of it like an ink splodge, diffusing mostly along the folds, creases and edges of a piece of blotting paper. Henry was listening and looking intently as Dr. Conway was talking and pointing everything out on the diagrams and on his laptop. It was not quite the sort of story he had expected, but if it was going to help him understand what Dr. Conway was really here to tell him, then it was worth his attention. By about 370,000 years ago, these northern emigres had become distinctly Eurasian rather than African. I'll avoid saying a different species because simplistic categorizations don't necessarily hold in this case. It also depends on which definition of species you choose and how you choose to interpret it. Remember that bit, please, because it's important, and we'll come back to it. Are you with me so far? Henry said, all the way, and I'm not lost aboard yet, so you're doing well. I'll assume that's a compliment, so thanks, I suppose. Now, it took something like 300 generations for the Eastern and Western Eurasian populations to become sufficiently different enough from the other to be on diverging evolutionary paths. Scientists give them different names, sometimes for nationalistic or political as much as scientific reasons, but for a lot of the time, they weren't absolutely one thing or another. In what's really quite a limited fossil record, many of the samples that have been found exhibit some common, some different features. Like everything, they were in transition, adapting and evolving all the time, over time. Only the later populations can really be considered to belong more definitely to one type or another. The same for us now, I suppose, Henry said. That's right. We're a chronospecies, and we all know somebody a bit less evolved than us, don't we? Henry was pleased that Dr. Conway had played along. And vice versa? Speak for yourself, Henry. I like to think of myself as more highly evolved than most. Anyway, this all took place continuously and over millennia, which is why you won't find any coordinates on diagrams and graphs like these that show evolution and migration over time. And what's more, what paleontologists think they can infer from bone morphology, their shape and size, and what paleogeneticists determine from DNA recovered from the same bones is interesting to compare and contrast. They don't always agree, not just the data, the scientists themselves, and there are all the usual consequences. Wisdom is the opinion of either the oldest or the most published professor present, said Henry. Something like that. The principle's not exclusive to scientists, though. As a soldier, you'll have seen it. You know, tactics being the opinion of the senior officer present and all that. Anyway, despite all the intellectual arguments in their journals and at conferences, they're all very complimentary and deferential towards each other when they apply the honour amongst thieves principles when they're on documentaries. But in my opinion, I can't see how any rational paleontologist can disagree. DNA evidence trumps bone and tooth shape every time. Now, forgive me for digressing there, Henry, but it's all relevant. Now, it's generally agreed that the Neanderthals finally died out in their last refuge, Gibraltar, around 35,000 years ago. The reasons why are another part of the story. But despite being extinct, they've actually managed to live on through their continued presence in our DNA. Ha! I don't think they died out. Our St. Major's missus reckon this place is full of Neanderthals, Henry said. He laughed, and Dr. Conway laughed with him. There was nothing forced about it. It was genuine, raucous laughter. Ha! Funny you should say that. There's this renowned researcher in this field, the best I'd say. He likes to offer a little anecdote in the same sort of vein. It was his team that first published the Neanderthal genome back in 2010 and very altruistically made it freely available in the public domain. Straight away, he started getting emails from people who self-identified as Neanderthals. After a while, he says, he started to see a pattern in the correspondence. It was almost exclusively men writing to say so. By contrast, and no surprises you'd think, very few women self-identified as Neanderthals.
He showed this to his researchers, tongue-in-cheek, of course. Always critical of him at his own insistence, they just dismissed it. Anecdotal rubbish, they all said. They attributed it to men being more interested in molecular biology than women. Far from it, he came back, because to him, lots of women were writing to him, but only to suggest that their husbands were Neanderthals. However, and no surprises again, no men were writing to suggest their wives were Neanderthal. And, wait for it, no man has yet had the balls to do it. Well, he really needs to get eyes on our Sergeant Major's missus, then. She comes from Merthyr Tydfil. She's what they call a valley commando. It's a nice coincidence. That old truism, it takes one to know one, definitely applies to her. Although none of us has got the balls to say it to her or him, in that order, said Henry. Once their shared amusement had died down again, he added. And as far as all this applies to me? And as far as all this applies to you, would you mind if my DSTL colleague, Dr. Benjamin Taban, joined us? The more the merrier, said Henry. He had tried to sound trite and flippant, but he was now certain that the answer to his earlier question would definitely be neither simple nor straight if it needed a private consultation with two expert government scientists to deliver it to him. Ben, called out Dr. Conway. Henry heard a knock on the door and stood up as it opened. A tall, imposing black man walked in, holding out his hand for Henry to take it. Henry, pleased to meet you. I'm Dr. Benjamin Taban. I work in the same program domain as Dr. Theo here. We have a shared interest in you, and please call me Benjamin, or Ben, as you like. I don't mind, but Ben's my preference. Pleased to meet you, sir, Henry replied, keeping his distance. They shared the same hydraulic press of a handshake that Henry had experienced with Dr. Conway, but again, there was no thumb press or finger curl. They all sat down, and the two doctors looked at Henry while he looked at them. Henry's gaze settled on Dr. Taban as he noticed that he too kept his jacket buttoned closed. He also caught a glimpse of what looked like brown leather braces. Well now, Henry, you're clearly a bright chap, so can I safely assume that you're wondering quite what interest it is in you that Dr. Ben and I share? Henry sat back, folded his arms across his chest and assumed a defensive posture. When you put it like that, just a bit, he replied, huffing theatrically. Oh, please. It's nothing like that, Henry. We know you've already guessed it's about your DNA. Put simply, nobody has ever seen a modern, I should say contemporary, human genome like it. There was a time it would have been assumed that there was sample contamination, or that the sampler or the computers are misbehaving. But these days, there's pretty much no chance any of that would confuse the result. Your genome's what the analysis says it is. The thing is, though, it shouldn't be. I mean, what I'm really saying is, well, it can't be. We can't think of any natural reason why it should or could be what it is. We're all unique, Henry, but you're exceptionally unique. Dr. Conway paused again, waiting for a reaction. Henry chose deliberately to create the impression of being impassive and unflustered. This was what he had been waiting for, after all. It was what he had been expecting to hear about, and it looked like there was more to come. Any idea what an outlier is, Henry? Dr. Conway asked him. I know what it means generally, from maths and science, but I'm assuming you're going to tell me how it applies to my genome. The two doctors looked at each other, then at Henry. We are, said Dr. Taban. And what we're going to tell you, Henry, is going to result in a lot of things changing. Like what? Everything, Dr. Conway said. At first, it might just be a lot of talk and information you get from us. Unexpected, surprising, shocking maybe, but nothing life-threatening. It might feel like just words, not action, at least up front. And hopefully it'll stay that way. But in my opinion, Henry, and I'm talking as far off script as I dare for your benefit here, you might now be, let's say, living in interesting times. We all might, to be honest.
Really?
Why? Henry asked.
Well, that depends on who else takes an interest in you and what they want to get from you, Dr. Taban said. In a couple of minutes, Henry, your life's going to change a lot.
Now, before we go on with this, we need to set one thing straight, said Dr. Conway. I'm not an anthropologist or a geneticist. My speciality is the study of extremes of human physical performance. But as a government scientist and a programme manager, I've got to cover a lot of bases. I'm not what you'd call a subject matter expert on the human genome, paleogenetics, paleoanthropology, or for that matter, paleo anything. Far from it. Although I can call on plenty of expertise when I need it. And I'm a psychologist, added Dr. Taban. I've spent most of the last 10 years at DSTL studying trauma, shock, and post-traumatic stress disorder. You'll know it better as PTSD. There, that's us, just so you know. Hopefully us not being geneticists ourselves mean we can keep our conversation mostly understandable between the three of us, Dr. Conway continued. Right then. An outlier, as you suggested you already know, is defined as a person or thing that's situated away or detached from the main body or system, or that differs significantly from all other members of a particular group or set. So, back to DNA from extinct hominin species in the modern human genome. Hominid, by the way, describes all species of extinct and modern great apes, including us, but also chimps, orangutans and gorillas. Hominin describes all modern humans, extinct human species and all our immediate ancestors. It's a fairly new and narrower term that covers just us and our closest human relatives, as it were. So, as well as watching your P's and Q's, see that you watch your N's and D's, Henry cut in. Okay, H. Ha, I'll bear that in mind, came the retort. Now, a person of mostly European ethnic heritage who has, say, 4% Neanderthal DNA would be considered an outlier. That's because the majority in that population group have less than 2% and a bit. If you recall, there's ethnic groups in East Asia and Oceania who have much more archaic DNA than that, but their genomes include contributions of both Neanderthal and Denisovan DNA. Even among them, somebody with over 4% Neanderthal DNA would be considered an outlier. And genomic outliers are, he paused again, clearly searching for the most apt phrase, of very great interest. By now, Dr. Conway's earlier light-hearted expression had been replaced with what Henry saw as straight-faced sincerity. His ruggedly handsome but stone-hard face, with its penetrating brown eyes, lent itself better to that than it did to smiling and being chatty. Henry also saw something else in Dr. Conway, something not altogether pleasant. Have you both had your DNA analysed?
Yes. All the programme staff have submitted cell samples for sequencing and analysis, and we each fit the profile expected for us, said Dr. Taban.
So, you're all genomic inliers, as it were. Do I take it from what you said that I've got 4% Neanderthal DNA? Henry asked.
Both doctors raised their eyebrows in answer.
More? 5?
Dr. Conway widened his eyes and raised his eyebrows again.
What then? 6? 7? Come on. It seems like if what you're both saying is right, I'm going to be spending my life all at 6s and 7s from now on.
Both doctors smiled thinly and huffed at the weak joke. Dr. Conway shook his head slowly, raising his eyebrows a third time.
But 7% would give me as much DNA from extinct human species, sorry, populations, as anybody who's got it from 2 or 3 or more different archaic sources.
Henry sat back in silence. He thought back to the National Geographic selection in the waiting room. He was convinced now. He had suspected from the start they must have been planted, and now he was certain.
He also understood why Dr. Conway had told him his story and why it was so detailed and informative. The medical team, and now these two, had almost certainly used some form of psychological conditioning techniques on him, however crude and clumsy they may have been. Looking back, it seemed more like they were dropping unsubtle hints. He knew it, and he also knew that it was to prepare him, or perhaps to soften him up, for what might be coming next. He was ready for it, whatever it was. Ugh, go on then, shoot. Chapter 3. Outside Interest. At about the same time as Henry was about to be briefed in Royal Marines Base Chivener, known as Heaven in Devon, in Denmark's Zeeland region, a black Land Rover Discovery, left-hand drive with Danish plates, was taking the exit at junction 39 off the northbound E47. It headed northwest as far as Hammer Torup, and from there it headed towards Hammer and an isolated house beyond the hamlet. The driver was a pumice-faced man of about 40. His hair was cut short all over. He's wearing a black jeans, a black roll neck, and a black leather jacket. He also wore a pair of mirrored sunglasses that hid his eyes completely from any scrutiny. Talking to him might have felt like talking to a giant predatory insect. His passenger was a woman in her early 30s, her hair short but not in an austere or manly style. She wore jeans, a pink collarless cotton shirt under her leather jacket, and the same sunglasses. She looked less aggressive and intimidating than her partner, although her expression was just as impassive, coldly unemotional and unforgiving. Both wore black steel toe-cap boots and the same ultra-thin black leather gloves. About half an hour behind them was a large, unmarked removals van, driven by a man who could have been the Discovery driver's younger brother. His two passengers had a similar appearance, although their demeanours spoke a little less convincingly of any underlying, measured, cold intelligence, and a little more convincingly of simmering malevolence and aggression. The house was set well back from the road. They pulled up outside the door, and the woman got out and to ring the bell. A short old woman opened the door as far as the security chain allowed. A flicker of annoyance appeared on the caller's face. This was evidently the housekeeper she'd been warned about. She would have to go. "What do you want?" the housekeeper said curtly. The caller replied, speaking in flawless Danish, to anyone but a forensic linguist. She sounded like a well-to-do young Copenhagen professional. "Is this the place where you make the beautiful pottery?" "No," came the answer. The door began to close. "Oh, wait, wait. Can you tell me where it is? It's near here somewhere, isn't it?" "I don't know. Go away. Goodbye." "Please, more. It's very important," the young woman pleaded. She had used the endearing term for maternal grandmother to make her point. The old woman was momentarily taken by surprise at that. Then, all in the same continuous, fluid movement, the visitor barged the door heavily with her shoulder and placed a boot in the opening. Taking full advantage of the brief pause she had created, she pulled a small pair of tactical bolt croppers from inside her jacket. She used them quickly and expertly to cut the security chain. The sudden action caught the housekeeper off guard, and she stumbled back. The younger woman was in the house in the blink of an eye. Dropping her bolt croppers, she darted behind the old woman, one arm snaked out around the lower part of her face, pulling downwards and backward pressure on her jaw and covering her mouth to prevent her from crying out. The other was wrapped around the top of her face, covering her eyes and pressing her nose down, causing immediate pain. The assailant gave a quick shake of her powerful swimmer's shoulders to make it clear that it would be easy for her to convert this headlock into a neck-snapping twist. She used the controlling hold and a few robust digs from her knees to move the old woman out towards the waiting vehicle. The driver opened the rear door and, as his partner shoved a piece of damp cloth into their victim's mouth, he bundled her up into the back. Her hands were carefully placed into restraints that were already fitted to a length of rope fixed to a bolt in the floor. "Are they here? Where are they?" demanded the man in a low voice,
but in a harsh-sounding language the old woman did not understand. His partner elbowed him out of the way, muttering in the same language that he was forgetting himself. "Look at me. The couple who live here. Are they in?" she demanded in Danish. "You'll be helping them if you tell the truth. Now." She drew her pistol, which prompted wide-eyed, frantic nodding. "Thank you, Momo," said the young woman. The man tipped out some liquid from a brown glass bottle onto a pad, which he placed over the old woman's face. The pad had two elastic straps, which he pulled behind her head to hold in place. "Sleep well and long," he said for his own amusement, this time in tortured Danish. He smiled coldly at her before getting into the driver's seat. He moved the vehicle down the drive a little way, the front facing the road, to block anybody arriving, and more importantly, to block anyone trying to get away. He walked back to his partner, and they both stood at the front door. Each gave the other a quick glance, and the woman, apparently annoyed, looked at her watch. They were running late. She nodded towards the open door. When the man had readied his own pistol, she led the entry into the house while he covered her. At her signal, he followed her in. The main rooms had the look of having been vacated in haste. The pair moved tactically through the house, silent as two prowling cats, until they drew up at a closed door. They looked at each other and nodded. Both allowed themselves a twitch of a smile as they stood back, one on each side of the door frame. Gingerly, the man gripped the handle, pressed it down, and pushed the door inwards. There was a plaintive shout from the room, in accented English this time. "Go away, I have a gun. If you come in, I'll shoot." The black-clad man sighed and rolled his eyes skywards. Then he produced a small cylinder from his jacket. He pushed the on button and tossed it into the room. Immediately the device emitted a deafening screaming noise and a brilliant white flashing light that disorientated the old couple. It had the effect of a flashbang stun grenade, but would leave no chemical residues, no physical evidence to be exploited. The younger pair outside vaguely heard the old man's shotgun clatter uselessly to the floor as he was forced to cover his ears with his hands. 3 seconds later, the noise and light stopped, and the pair went in, the man first, covered by the woman, and then as he came to a stop, covering her, she followed. Both stood, weapons brought to bear on the terrified and frail-looking elderly couple. An antique-looking shotgun lay, useless, at the old man's feet. The young woman motioned that the couple should stand apart. Reluctantly, they shuffled until they were separated by a good 6-foot gap. The two visitors held their pistols in their right hands, aim unwavering, while reaching into the inside right of their jackets with their left hands. Each pulled out a very small spray can. They both moved towards the old couple, the man towards the husband, and his partner towards the wife. They gave a brief spray of their aerosol cans at the old couple's faces before stepping back. The two victims fell immediately to the floor, hands over their eyes, writhing in agony, grunting and moaning through clamped teeth. The pair holstered their pistols, put away their non-lethal oleoresin capsicum sprays, and carefully set about restraining their victims. They used soft-padded wrist and ankle cuffs that would leave no marks, even in the event of a struggle. The man fetched a jug of water from the kitchen and began to rinse the pepper spray residue from the old couple's faces. The two visitors helped the reluctant hosts to sit upright on a sofa. After several minutes' recovery, the young woman stood in front of them and signalled them to look at her, and her only. She was holding a folio of laminated white pages on which messages and questions in Danish were written in large black type. The first question asked if they knew the whereabouts of Julius and Joanna Bell's son. They both shook their heads, and shook them even more insistently when the man drew and pointed his pistol and aimed his pepper spray in their direction. The next question asked when they had last seen the boy. They agreed it had been summer at least 6 years ago, probably more. The next questions asked if they had any photographs in which the boy appeared or anything of his in the house. They were both emphatic that they had no pictures and nothing that had ever belonged to him. The young woman showed them several more questions, to which all the responses seemed similarly negative and unhelpful. It was evident that whatever relationship these two might have had with the boy and his parents, it had been little more than occasional contact that had ceased years ago. Clearly there was nothing of him here. The question on the woman's next card sought the contact details for a list of names. She watched the man look blankly at them, shake his head and shrug his shoulders. He had no idea. No matter. If there was information about these people, it could be found somewhere. It would just have to be found somewhere else. The final question demanded the passwords to their computer and any others required to access files or email, and the whereabouts of correspondence address books, if they had any. The man checked the PC's password, but it failed to work. He returned to inform his partner by signing to her. She tapped the question, wagged her finger admonishingly, and then sprayed the old woman in the face again, after which she held her pistol against her grey-haired head, all the while looking into the old man's eyes through her sunglasses. He relented and the passwords proved valid. Their task was to ask their questions but not to press too hard of answers, to get what could be got, move on and above all, to leave no witnesses or traces. The young woman next drew out an envelope from inside her jacket and took out a letter. She placed it on the coffee table and picked up a pen, which she put on top of it. Then she held up a sign that said simply that both must sign and date the letter. She released their right hands so that they could do so. The man was reluctantly compliant. His wife was as willing as he was, but not as fully able on account of her second dose of pepper spray. Once they both signed it, the young woman folded the letter and put it back in its envelope, which he left on the table. The old couple's hands were then restrained once again. While she kept watch over the old couple sat on their sofa, both looking up uncomfortably at her pistol, her partner went out to their vehicle. He came back carrying two large, thick-walled, clear plastic bags, a small grey gas cylinder with black shoulders that was fitted with a manifolded outlet control valve, and some narrow-bore tubing fitted with quick-release couplings. He set up the array, turned the gas on, and the old couple began breathing pure nitrogen. Over the next few minutes, they would quickly and gently become unconscious through anoxia, the prelude to dying from inert gas asphyxiation. They would have assisted each other in their desire to die together, just as their signed note said they would. The man went out, leaving his partner to watch over the demise of the old couple. He reversed the discovery back to the front of the house and then unshackled the old housekeeper's corpse, removed the pad from her face, carried her in, and laid her on the floor of the living room by the table. He placed his pepper spray into her hand, ensuring it was obvious that it had been used. He put the bottle of ether onto the coffee table, then knocked over the jug of water he'd used to wash away the pepper spray residues. When the bodies were discovered, a doctor would be called to certify the causes of death. As the suicide note was corroborated by the couple's corpses and the clear visual evidence, the circumstances of their death would not be declared suspicious. That way, there would be no need to involve the Medico-Legal Institute in Copenhagen to investigate further and deeper. The circumstantial evidence would also confirm that their housekeeper, who had clearly tried to prevent their suicide, had died accidentally for her troubles. That was the plan, and the black-clad pair were convinced they'd made a good job of executing it successfully and convincingly. The woman texted a single code word to a contact mobile number, which was the signal that the removal van was not required and the backup team should return to Copenhagen. While she fixed the severed security chain, her partner removed their vehicle's registration plates and fitted it with a different set, legitimately registered to another black discovery. This would help reduce the chance of any roadside surveillance systems tracing their round trip. Before leaving, they copied all the data on the couple's computer hard drive and found an old address book in their writing bureau. Their final act before leaving was to knock over the bottle of ether. In this case, there was to be no cleaning out of the property or getting the bodies cremated. The black-clad pair had done only as much as their task order had required of them. They had an idea before arriving there would be little, if anything, of use here. As anticipated, nothing of consequence had been gleaned from the old couple, but their deaths
meant two more potential sources of trouble had been struck off the target list. They left the house, and the man, carrying the veteran's shotgun away, pulled the front door closed behind him. That effectively closed this episode, as far as they were both concerned. In the vehicle, the pair each put on a different pair of sunglasses and a baseball cap pulled down low. They drove off as if nothing out of the ordinary had occurred. In their world, nothing out of the ordinary had occurred. Except, that is, they left with an unaccustomed and uncomfortable feeling. It seemed that, unlike when they had dealt with the strange old English couple, and then with their even stranger lawyer in Brussels, and the others before and after them, this time they had been expected. Chapter 4. Lucky 13. Henry, you've got 13% Neanderthal DNA. You aren't just an outlier. You're an outlier among outliers. Henry, you are the outlier, capital O. You're almost certainly the only person in the world who's had this much Neanderthal DNA for probably 45,000 years. The only example we have of anything like it is called Oaz I. He's a 44,000-year-old fossil found in Romania. He had 11% Neanderthal DNA. So he could have had a single, full-blood Neanderthal relative 4 generations back. Understandable then, maybe, when there were still Neanderthals in Central Europe. But now, in your case, nobody, and I mean nobody, can see how it's naturally possible. There was a brief silence. Henry thought that Dr. Conway had been about to add a further comment or qualifier, but he didn't. Instead, he said, "I'm going to let Dr. Ben have some time with you now, before we take this any further." He stood up and strode out of the room, leaving Henry and Dr. Taban sat looking at each other in studied silence. "So, Ben, he's just told me I've got terminal cancer, and you're now playing the Macmillan nurse here in case I break down. Is that right?" Henry asked. "Henry, I'm here today with Dr. Theo to support you, should you need it. Sure, I need to assess how I think you're taking this news and how you're coping, but it's nothing like as bleak a picture as you're just painting." Henry raised his eyebrows at that, but said nothing. "Why don't we start by discussing what's going through your mind right now?" "Well," started Henry, having decided it was pointless being awkward, "I don't feel like some sort of Dr. Jekyll who's just been told that he's got a previously unknown, deeply hidden inner Mr. Hyde who can now go out and wreak his havoc." "Ha, I like that. I wish I thought of it myself, actually. And you're right. It's not like you've got some violent inner caveman you knew nothing about until just now, which I suppose is saying the same sort of thing. So I'm not going to have to shoot you if you suddenly make to throw a fire-hardened wooden spear at me, because it's just not going to happen," he said, patting his jacket just under his left armpit. "Anyway, that Neanderthal stereotype's long since debunked. And the 13% spread across your whole genome. It's absent, or rather there's no more than anybody else has got, in certain key areas. For example, your brain and your testicles. Although at your age they can be considered as two parts of the same organ. In many cases we can't yet be sure that these archaic genes will actually do anything. But some will certainly do something, won't they? Surely." "Oh, certainly. And forgive me here, Henry, because I'm a mind's and not a body's man. But it's not like, say, displaying physical characteristics from a mixed race heritage attributable to just one racially different great-grandparent. It's far more complex and subtle than anything like that. The evidence isn't necessarily visibly obvious, or even visible." "Look, I know it's your job and all, but how can you ask me how I feel about being more Neanderthal than you? As far as I can see, you're not of European ethnic heritage or mixed race, and you haven't got any Neanderthal DNA. It's not like any of these things have to bother you, is it?" Henry said, more sharply than he has intended. "No offence meant," he added. "None taken. But don't just rush to judge, Henry. Yes, my ethnic heritage is visibly African. Southeastern Sudanese, to give it a recent location, although I'm a Londoner born and bred. You're right, though. Most people who, at first glance, look like me have little or no Neanderthal DNA. But in fact, I've got something approaching 0.5%. I'm told it could be attributable to the migration of Neanderthals, or more likely the return of humans with bits of Neanderthal DNA, into northeastern Africa. Everybody talks about it like it was just one-way traffic out of Africa. Apparently not. My ancestors were probably on one of the routes people took to drift out and back in. When the small matter of the Sinai and the Sahara deserts allowed it, that is. Even so, you can't see any overtly physical Neanderthal characteristics in me. That's because the Neanderthal DNA that I've got's nothing to do with appearance. It's mostly to do with my immune system. I have to say, I'm rather proud to be just a little bit Neanderthal. You know, a living custodian of some precious fragment of our extinct human past. Henry nodded contritely. Having acknowledged this as a fair point, he then asked, "Did the analysis say in any detail what Neanderthal genes I do have?" "You studied biology at school, didn't you?" Henry nodded in agreement. "Well then, you'll appreciate that question deserves much more than just a yes or no answer. It's believed that in its small quotients of 2% or so, around half of the Neanderthal genome survives in the modern human population in the form of intact genes, and maybe more. As more people's genomes are sequenced, the figure rises. It's about 60% for the Denisovan genome, and shame on you if you don't find that amazing. Now, some of those genes are already seen both in modern humans today and in samples sequenced from Neanderthal fossils were found in your genome. So it's reasonable to assume they're from the extant pool of circulating archaic genes. Others were complete genes that have previously only been sequenced from Neanderthal fossil sources as fragments, but not yet seen in living people. I emphasise not yet, but still, their presence in your DNA is a bit of an enigma to say the least. The two looked each other in the eye briefly before Dr. Taban continued. Of course, these genes could reside in somebody somewhere whose DNA has never been sequenced. They could also have been seen as more complete genes in a very special fossil sample, maybe one not yet declared to the scientific community. That's very unlikely, though, because no sane scientist would hide a discovery like that. We can't yet say precisely, or even vaguely, what all these genes do, if indeed they do anything. That said, their position in your genome may give some idea as to their function. I'm afraid I'm not really doing justice to the body of knowledge that exists, Henry, but it all gets rather complex to me, a psychologist, once you start talking specific gene names, base pair sequences and what they all do. That would be a lot of bases to cover, said Henry, trying to sound absent-minded, but in fact testing Dr. Taban's sense of humour and his recall. He was rewarded with a suppressed half-smile. Does having Neanderthal genes in some places mean not having, you know, human genes there? Is it right to draw the distinction that clearly? I suppose what I'm asking is, does being 13% Neanderthal mean being only 87% human? Like I said before, Henry, that's far too simplistic a way of describing what is in reality a much more complex situation. These genes don't exist in two distinct blocks. You can't have a Neanderthal head and arms on an anatomically modern human body, for example. Anyway, it's wholly inappropriate to start thinking about yourself in percentage human terms. You study history, so you'll know the ultimate expression of that attitude can result in unspeakable and, forgive me here, inhuman consequences. It's fundamentally unsound to suggest somebody's genetically a 100% pure human, and by that rationale, that somebody else isn't. Ha! Well, right now, and from where I'm sitting, it's difficult not to, Henry replied. Well, just try not to, can you? Now, imagine, and you're going to have to imagine, because this is purely hypothetical, a pure-blood Neanderthal man living amongst us recently. We're going to follow his family down the male line, and we'll consider only nuclear DNA. Let's assume that he and his fertile male offspring have children only with modern women, humans, who've got no Neanderthal DNA. Dr. Taban turned one of his diagrams over and began sketching a conceptual family tree as he spoke. All other things being equal, which they wouldn't be at all in this example, Then his son inherits 50% of his genetic material from him. He continued to extend the branches of the tree to represent subsequent generations as he spoke. The grandson ends up with 25% of it, and so on. Here we go until we reach the great-great-great-grandson, who has 3 and a bit percent. This is all very simplistic, I know. That's from pure Neanderthal here. He pointed to his sketch and looked up briefly at Henry. So 3% Neanderthal down here in just 5 generations. Call it what? 100? Certainly no more than 150 years. In our terms, that is, most Neanderthals were dead before they reached 40. For your 13%, that's him there, look, it's 3 generations. When you were younger, you would have known that full-blood Neanderthal in his dotage. Does that sound implausible? Well, it did, and Henry acknowledged as much. Now, Dr. Theo will be able to tell you better than me, but there have been a good 1,000 generations since the last Neanderthals died out, possibly twice that many generations since their last acknowledged intimate encounters with modern humans, which was well before their extinction. The main inferences are, 1, the hybrids must have bred with hybrids within human communities to keep the Neanderthal DNA in circulation. 2, what remained in circulation was stable and compatible. And 3, it's been a good long time for harmful Neanderthal DNA to have been selectively eased out, as it were. And there's been a long time for the level of Neanderthal DNA that sits comfortably on the modern human genome to reach its current steady state. Henry chose to ignore the missing parts of Dr. Taban's explanation and rationale. But 13% isn't the steady state, is it? It's between 6 and 10 times steady state, and about 25 times what you've got. Again, he was quite robustly insistent. Dr. Taban chose to allow Henry to carry on. How do I know if what I've got isn't DNA that doesn't, what is it, sit comfortably on the human genome? And how do I know that what I'm missing, and what you have got, by the way, isn't harmful? I mean, the Neanderthals died out once modern humans came on the scene, and now the global population is around 7 billion and rising. So modern humans must have been superior to Neanderthals, I take it. You see where I'm coming from with this. Does being 13% Neanderthal make me inferior? A subspecies? Subhuman? What's the term? An Untermensch? Ah, far from it, Henry. Ethnic differences aside, and they're as far as on the scale of the human genome is concerned, they're inconsequential. You're certainly different. Unique, as far as we know. But that's all. By the percentage rationale, the only humans who can trace a somewhat more direct and uninterrupted line than ours to the common ancestor are isolated, archaic, sub-Saharan African populations, possibly. All the rest of us around the world aren't quite as fully pure, but then they're not truly pure anyway. We're all multiple species human hybrids who've all got extinct human types among our relatively recent ancestors. There's no suggestion that you're somehow less than human, or me for that matter, because I've got Neanderthal DNA too, remember? Or that some sand hunter-gatherers in the Namib are a purer form of hybrid human than both of us, because they've got none. I mean, who's to say that you aren't, in the contemporary context, more than human? A better superior human, the superior human even. Maybe you're an Obermensch, a true new man. I mean, not in a politically correct sense, in a genetically correct sense. A new man like no other before. Human diversity personified. You see, Henry, human is who we are, not what we are or what we look like. Ah, that's very politically and genetically correct of you to say so, Ben. It sounds like it came straight off some official UN protocol compliant civil service anti-phobia proprietary checklist. And it'd be nice to think it's true. But statistically, we both know that I'm only 87% human. I think we all know, Henry, there are statistics, damn statistics and lies. You defy simplistic categorisation, that's all. Who's to say that you aren't the future great patriarch of some new branch of the human family? What if, because you're somehow better adapted, anybody who's going to survive the next global flu pandemic and start repopulating the world once the rest of us have sweated, coughed and sneezed ourselves to death has to have a genome more like yours and mine, or Theo's, or anybody else who's now alive for that matter? Who knows a genome that must be derived from yours? It takes a special sort of new man to help her create a new population, you know. Henry leaned back, and, hands behind his head, he closed his eyes briefly and laughed. Ha! There you go again. A new man like no other before. I must say, the thought of queues of Eves lining up to conceive my offspring for the good of humanity has a certain appeal to a chap of my age, he drawled. Then, becoming suddenly more serious, he dropped his arms and folded them again. You see, what I'm thinking right now is that in reality, I'm going to be spending the rest of my life having samples taken and being prodded, poked and tested, quarantined and forbidden from breeding, neutered maybe, just to be on the safe side. Nothing better than a medical chimp or a lab rat. A bit of both. An interspecies hybrid. How ironic is that? And Dr. Taban could not stop himself from smiling. Then, stern again, he said, There's no denying, Henry. There would be intense interest in you from various interested parties from across the world. Henry made no issue of the way Dr. Taban had said would be, although he thought that it sounded ominous somehow. Okay, maybe not a lab rat then. What about a circus freak? A new elephant man? Roll up, roll up! Come and have a gulp at the real missing link. Or one of those chimps from Planet of the Apes, you know, turned into a celebrity alien, then cynically seen off for being a threat to humanity's future. I mean, that's pretty much what was done by humans to the Neanderthals, wasn't it? Great, he said, his tone heavy with sarcasm. It's perfectly understandable you should feel this way, and I'm pleased you're prepared to share your thoughts and feelings with me. The best thing you can do to help yourself is to understand and accept that you're, well, you're one of a kind. Yeah, or maybe one of a critically endangered species previously unknown to science. The last of a dying breed, Henry offered back. Dr. Taban eyed him, then added earnestly, very concerned, Henry, are you okay? Henry's cheeks reddened. He usually coloured moments of intense emotional turmoil with humour, and now was one of those moments. He answered with a very well-impersonated line from one of his all-time favourite movies. Nah, man, I'm pretty fucking far from okay.